You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 44. Hello and welcome to today's show. So today I've got a fantastic interview with you about online safety. We're going to go straight into the interview, but I just want to give you a warning that the sound quality isn't 100% consistent throughout. We had difficulty recording it, but it's really, really worth listening to. And in places it improves and in places it gets worse again. So I really do want to encourage you to listen to, because I think our guest Simon Aston has so much positive stuff and really useful stuff to share with us. So let's go straight over to today's show. Our guest today is Northamptonshire's online safety officer. I first heard about him when he came to do a talk for parents at my children's school. I was working that evening, so my husband went along and he raved about it. He has been doing this work for 3 years and travels across the county and the country, delivering sessions in schools and for parents, youth clubs, social work and counsellors. He also works very closely with the police around online safety and self-esteem. He is passionate about mental health, safeguarding, critical thinking and resilience. He worries that everything we see online is perfect, and he's working to make society rethink the way we deliver online safety, especially in schools, to engage better with young people. He is also very keen to spread the message that the internet is wonderful, and I second that. I try to build a space on the internet that is a safe and positive place that's really useful for teenagers. It's not the technology that's the problem, it's the way we use it. He sums his work up in this quote: do more things that make you forget to check your phone. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Simon Aston.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's fantastic to have you here, Simon. So when I was researching this interview, I found that you said somewhere that students are bored with the same online safety messages delivered in the same way over and over again. So what should we be doing as adults and parents differently, and why?
I think one of the things that I speak a lot about is how young people now, well, the young people of this generation have been labelled Generation Z because they're the first group of young people to be born into all of this technology. And example I often give to parents, social workers, practitioners is that the first mobile phone was made in 1984. It was a Motorola. It would have cost you $4,500. It took 10 hours to charge. With that 10 hours of charge, it only lasted 30 minutes and only stored 30 contact numbers. When I talk to young people about that, they can't process that because they don't know any different to smartphones, because the first group of, like I say, young people to be born into it all. We can't hold that against them. They want to be vloggers. They look up to vloggers. They want to be almost social media stars. There's a danger that comes with that, but we need to encourage that, for me, as long as they're doing it safely. And one of the things that teenagers said to me not that long ago is that we're kind of fed up with being told how to behave online, kind of fed up with being patronized about kind of, you know, what to do on the internet. And the three areas that you mentioned there that I really do feel that we need to go over with young people in terms of keep them safe is sort of the resilience, digital resilience, self-esteem and critical thinking. And also, we often get a bit blindsided by the technology in terms of keeping young people safe online. And the example that I'll give you, if I've got a load of young people that are bullying each other, let's say on Snapchat, is Snapchat sending out those messages by itself? No. Therefore, it's the young people's behavior. So in order to keep young people safe online, we need to challenge their behavior. So the big shift that I've had this academic year and what we need to do with young people is to talk to them about their behavior online, explore with them ways to keep safe, be really positive about the internet, and teach them how to use it safely from a young age.
Yeah, definitely. That's so interesting. And I think it's such a helpful shift in perspective, because at the end of the day, these are just tools, aren't they, for communication?
Exactly.
The same as speech is a tool for communication. And if what comes out of your mouth is nice and encouraging and positive, that's fantastic. But if what you say is, you know, discriminatory or bullying or unkind in some way, you know, you're abusing that communication tool in the same way as if you were transmitting it through Snapchat or Instagram.
Yeah,
so that's fantastic. So what I'd like to do, Simon, actually, is break down those three areas that you just mentioned, safeguarding, critical thinking, and digital resilience. So can you start with safeguarding then and tell us what we should be saying to our children about how to stay safe online?
I think one of the key things, if I try and break it down into sort of, you know, quite young children, I'm talking probably eight or just under. So I'm not a parent. I've got a niece who's two and she's absolutely brilliant. I love spending time with her. And one of the things that I often say in my sessions is one of the first presents that I actually bought Isla was a toy mobile phone. And usually when I mention that to parents, practitioners, there's a sharp intake of breath. And I just want to explore that in terms of, I don't want my niece to be addicted to the internet. I'm not saying that I want her to have free range on the internet. But one of the things that worries me in terms of parenting in the digital age, and going back from sort of answering the question around safeguarding, is that if we teach young people from as early as possible on how to use the internet safely, then surely that's going to only help them as they grow up. I often liken internet safety to teaching a child how to ride a bike. We don't wait till a child's 10, do we, before we put them on sort of a bike. We get them an appropriate size bike at the right age. We give them stabilizers. We prop them up. We hold on to them. They go a few feet at a time. And as they get more confident, the bike gets bigger and the stabilizers come off. One of my big worries with Generation Z, young people now, is we're giving them the internet at a very early age without stabilizers. So if parents have got a 5, 6, 7 year old, what I encourage is from as early as possible, sit down with them and explore the internet with them. Go through, for example, the YouTube for Kids app. It is YouTube. I can't say that nothing inappropriate is going to pop up because that's one of the problems that we face with the internet. But I do want parents to sit down with their children, explore it together from as early as possible, because if we don't allow children some digital time and we wrap them up in cotton wool, that will fuel a lot of anxiety. And that is sort of one of my big concerns that I have when I work with parents and practitioners. The other concern that I have is that we get that side, or we get the other side where we give a child a full-blown Instagram at the age of 8 and we don't give them any privacy settings. So that's what I want to do with really young children. And the other thing, as they get older and they start to explore more in terms of online gaming, the same rules apply. If they're using Roblox or Minecraft, just be wary, because within those games there's a messaging service, and very similar to Facebook Messenger, and the way that games are built are the same way that social media accounts are built. It's the same information that goes into them. So parents, practitioners, explore it with children, be positive around it, see what they enjoy about it, reinforce the message that not everybody on the internet is who they say they are. Make sure they understand sort of what personal information is and why it's important to keep that to yourself. And I often call it, with quite young children, the otto feeling. So if we see anything on the internet that gives us that otto feeling, butterflies in our tummy, who do we talk to? But as they get older, one of the things that I really want parents to understand and explore is boundaries and communication will go so much further than blocking. So ideally, I want parents to sit down with their children and have some online safety rules within the home. However, at the heart of the rule setting is the child. Parents' role within that is the negotiator and the facilitator. So if the child says, I want to be on YouTube for 10 hours a day, then we negotiate that. And that's the negotiator facilitator stage that I want the parent to go through. And then I also want, ideally, from as young as possible, as part of the rule settings, that the child sets the consequences, because the child will be far harsher on the consequences they do themselves, and also they're more likely to buy into them. As children get older, they're going to explore more in terms of social media. So what I will say, and a lot of adults don't realise this as well, but there's a saying out there, there's no such thing as for free. 75% of free mobile apps store, save and sell on information. So Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, Minecraft, Roblox, any free app will store our information and essentially sell it on. That's why they're worth so much money. what Snapchat will do with information is incredible. They'll sell on phone numbers, photos, whatever goes to Instagram. We don't own that. Instagram do. When we open a free mobile app or a social media account for the first time, we're signing a pre-licensing agreement. And what that essentially means is we're happy for them to do whatever they want with our information. So these are the conversations that I want parents to have. Sadly, the world of online grooming is a massive thing now. When I was growing up, we were always told to look out for sort of dodgy suspect characters at parks. We've moved on from that now. So in terms of safeguarding children, parents are far safer in letting their children go unaccompanied to the park on their own than they are letting them sit and supervise on the internet. But the best way to keep children safe from an early age is teach, in terms of the internet, teach them how to use it safely, because that will only help in terms of parents understanding it. Be positive around it with their internet use. Don't wrap them up in cotton wool, and make sure they're educated age appropriately around that the internet is can be a scary place. We don't want to frighten children, but we also need to tell them that, you know, if a stranger pops up on the internet, somebody we don't know, that they need to speak to an adult.
Okay, that's really interesting, Simon. So I think one of the most interesting things you said there to me was about boundaries, and this is something I talk to parents an awful lot about, is their responsibility as parents to set the boundaries.
Absolutely.
And I just wondered, firstly, what you would suggest doing if parents have found themselves in a situation where the child's kind of phone use or game use or whatever kind of thing has just got out of control, and they can see that, and they can see that some boundaries need to be put in place. How would you suggest that they go about doing that?
It's a really good question. If I give you an example that I had the other day, I had a young lad, and his mom was sort of, lad was at home, and mom had come out sort of on a parent session, and mom was clearly quite exasperated with her teenage son's sort of online behaviour. But when we started to get to the bottom of it all, one of the things that I noticed sort of quite sort of quickly was that mom was sort of getting quite tired of telling her son the same message over online gaming, and she was going home and having this constant battle with him about, you know, too much time on the internet and you need to come off it and go and enjoy sort of the sunshine out in the real world, and the child was sort of resisting and going the other way. And that's quite common. If a parent is facing a battle in terms of the boundaries sort of within the home, what tends to happen in my experience is parents tend to block everything or remove things, and that will just exasperate the problem. There is a theory out there called reactance theory, and what reactance theory is all about is if you give a child or an adult very, very strict boundaries around anything, you will push them into areas that we don't really want them to go into. So it goes back to, for me, if a parent is really struggling in terms of the boundaries, get the child to come up with some rules themselves. Make sure the parent facilitates on those rules and get them to set some of the consequences. If I liken it to when I was a teenager, my parents used to say to me, I grew up in a very rural village in the West Midlands, and my parents used to say to me, Simon, I don't want you drinking on street corners. So what I did is I never used to drink on street corners in my little village because everybody knew everybody. So I used to get the bus to my local town when nobody knew me, buy me drink underage, have a swig on it and think I was really cool, and then be sick about an hour later. But the problem we had there was that parents persistently telling me not to do something, and often when we do that with children, you're going to force them into the behaviour that we don't want them to go into.
Yeah, so it would be much safer for you to drink on the street corner in your village than to go to the local town and drink there. So your parents forced you into that unsafe behaviour.
Exactly. So what we want is it goes back to children being at the heart of the rule setting, because they're more likely to buy into it. And what'll happen is, another example, a few months ago, the teenage girl that was, we were really worried in terms of, again, her online behaviour, but parents had removed and blocked everything within the home, and all that was doing was exasperating the problem. And it's really important that if we get the boundaries and communication, but if we get that communication open with children from a young age, that means that door's going to be always open in terms of children telling parent their problems. And what often happens is when sort of we rant and rave at children, or we're quite strict with the boundaries, they're just going to shut off, and they will go the opposite way in terms of where we want them to go in with with their behaviour. And I think, I know I keep mentioning this, I keep sort of repeating myself, but I think it's so important that children are at the heart of the rule setting. And within the home, we have a family agreement the children lead on, but also what's very important as part of that family agreement, parents sign up to that as well. Parents need to be very careful with their online behaviour and be strong digital role models. One of my pet hates is when I'm out and about, whether it's work or friends, and I'm sort of in a coffee shop or in a restaurant. We don't see families talking anymore. We just see them sat on mobile phones. If we've got a parent grabbing a child every 30 seconds and having a selfie with them, well, that's learned behaviour. I was in a supermarket the other day and a toddler started crying in his pram. And rather than mom perhaps give out the dummy or go and comfort him, she gave him a tablet. And it comes back to this learned behaviour. These rules within the home will only work if parents sign up to them, you know. They should be digital free zones. We've now got 1 in 5 young people checking messages on social media in the 1 in 5 young people checking messages on social media in the early hours of the morning. 1 in 8 of us sleep within a meter of our mobile phone, and 1 in 10 young people regularly access the internet between midnight and 6 a.m. in the morning. Yeah. Bedrooms have got to be digital free zones, and it is all about not just young people being the heart of the rule setting, but parents leading by example as well.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with that. And I hear so many stories about students who they have their phones with them all night long. They use them as alarm clocks, yeah, and all that kind of thing. And my advice always is, like, the first thing you do to get your child on track is to buy them an alarm clock and put that mobile, yeah, phone downstairs between 10 and 6 at the minimum. I just wanted to come back with one thing, because I work with one family,
yep,
and they,
yes,
were having a lot of problems with Snapchat and, like, it being used,
yes,
late into the night. And the mother actually, yes, said, right, I'm taking it away at 10 o'clock. And
yep,
she said that her daughter was actually secretly relieved. Like, she wouldn't admit it to her mum, but she could,
yeah,
tell,
yeah,
that she was secretly pleased that her mum had put this boundary in place. So,
yeah,
I'm just wondering how that fits in the context of the advice that you're giving. Like, if the child just doesn't have the willpower and can't stand up to the social pressure to not be,
yeah,
on their phone, how do you manage that when you're actually, as a family, setting the rules?
I think that's a really good point. Now, obviously what the parents done there is absolutely her call, and I completely understand that. And what I often advise people and young people, practitioners, teachers, wherever I'm working with, is be mindful of your behaviour online. And if you're, so from a young person's point of view, I do try and advocate, have a break from it. It's okay to come away from social media, because social media has been described as, Snapchat is social media, it's been described as more addictive than cigarettes and alcohol. In that case, obviously that's worked, and I think it's the parent having that dialogue with their child and knowing what's best for their child. And that's why, if we keep going back to it, but the family rules, okay, it might be, if you use that word, a drastic measure might be to go and take the phone away, but if that's what the parent feels fit and will work with their child, then absolutely that's a judgment call. And if it's worked for their child, then that can only be a good thing. I think one of the, bringing it back to sort of the battles that I often face working with parents, that there's not even that, in terms of, I don't want to sort of say almost pigeonhole every parent here, but there's not even that almost kind of, right, I'm taking that phone off you at midnight. It's just you crack on with it and do what you want to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely.
And I think that's one of the battles that I often face. But if that parent has seen fit to do that, then I think, you know, good on them. I had a group of 8-year-olds saying to me the other day that if Snapchat didn't exist for a couple of days, they wouldn't be able to cope.
It's dreadful, isn't it?
You know,
and
this is, yeah, and it's a very good report. I encourage everybody to have a
What's
scan
it
over
called?
It. If you Google Life in Likes, it came out in January, and it's by the Children's Commissioner, and it's a fantastic report. And the Children's Commissioner, Anne Longford, is basically calling for all primary schools to deliver compulsory social media classes, because that report highlights that young people at the age of 8 are getting too caught up on likes in terms of social media. I have 10, 11-year-olds telling me there's nobody liked their photos. After a few hours, they'd be devastated. They'd quickly get rid of it and put another one up. We've got the average teenage girl spending 1 hour, 24 minutes a week perfecting the perfect selfie. You mentioned it at the start. One of my big concerns in terms of keeping children safe is not just the online sort of grooming bit, but it's the effect it's having on mental health.
Yes.
It's huge now, absolutely huge. And that report highlights that.
Yeah, Okay, that's brilliant. I will link to that in the show notes, but it's called Life in Likes by the Children's
Commission. Yeah, it's fantastic.
So I just wanted to ask a question here. So if parents and children are sitting down to make their digital house rules for the first time, what would you say is the minimum standard of healthy behaviour for a family in terms of their digital use that you would set? Or is that an unfair question?
No. I'll do my best to answer it. I think, like I said earlier, I think that the parent is going to know that child certainly better than me. And one thing that I say, time limits, start off with your rules. Time limits are very important. There's no government guidance to actually say how long a young person should spend on the internet. What I can say, though, is anything around that 3 to 4 hour mark on any form of technology, it could be a game, it could be a phone, comes with higher levels reporting anxiety and depression. So the first thing that I would want parents to do is with their children is have a time limit, and all the family buy into that. The next one, I mentioned this earlier, really is part of that rule setting, because this is easier for parents to manage in terms of blocking and reporting. Let's keep technology downstairs. Keep it downstairs. Technology is used near a parent. That way it's easier for parents to keep an eye on what they're doing. It is tricky for parents because young people are now telling me that they would quite happily cope if their TV, if TVs were taken out of the house. Because one of the things that young people are now doing is watching more things on YouTube and Netflix than they are actually watching potentially TV. So it's parents actually just having that dialogue, and I'll keep coming back to that dialogue with the young person. But in terms of rule setting, what I really want parents just to focus on as your starting point is parents being mindful of their own behaviour. I want parents to be we need a time limit. It can't just be free reign on the internet from an early age. And also leading into that, I know I've talked about this, but you're absolutely right, you know, with the alarm clock scenario that you mentioned, that we've got to try and make sure that young people are getting a good night's sleep. You know, an adolescent needs 9 hours, 45 minutes worth of sleep a night. Young people need somewhere around 7 to 9 hours sleep. When I work with young people, they've got massive bags under their eyes. They look very pale. They don't look well. And a lot of the time it's because they're not getting enough sleep. If we stick to those 3 Ds, digital free zones, digital role models, and digital sunset, that's the bare minimum, really, that I want parents to consider.
That's brilliant. And I just want to put in something there that's helped me in my own kind of digital role modelling. And that is actually deleting email and deleting the Facebook app from my phone. And I use them both a huge amount in my work, because I use Facebook to be in touch with people who are interested in what I do. But actually what that's done is set boundaries around when and how I do that work. And it's made me a lot calmer and a lot less anxious, because before I'd be like cooking the tea, check my phone, see if there's a Facebook update, go and chop a carrot, come back, check again. And so I was all over the place. And it's actually been really, really good for me to do this. And actually I found myself really moving in the other direction. And I was just checking email and Facebook on my computer or on my iPad. Now I've made a rule that I only check email twice a day, actually, on my computer. And it just gives you such freedom. And as a parent, my children aren't seeing me constantly going back to a phone or an iPad, seeing me checking stuff. So, I just wanted to throw that in as something that had worked for me.
No, and it's such a valid point. One of the things that I play to parents, it's probably the most impactful thing that I play to parents. If you put it into YouTube, it's called the Still Face Experiment. And it's an American psychiatrist talking over sort of toddler's behavior. And very briefly, toddler's in a high chair. Mom is engaging the child. All of a sudden, mom turns away and brings her face back to the child, and it's a very stony cold face that she's giving the child. The toddler becomes extremely distressed. The posture sort of goes. He's really sort of calling out for help. He's pointing to different areas of the room to try and get mom's attention. And the reason there's no phone involved in that video clip, but what I often say to parents is, you imagine that your child is engaging with you and you're not engaging back with them, you're on a phone. That's the same thing, and it's that learned behaviour. And I completely agree with you, Lucy. I'm very passionate about mental health, men and mental health in particular. Summer 2015, I took 3 months off work due to severe anxiety, and I talk very openly about my battles with anxiety. It's completely changed me for the better. I would never have said that going through it because I was extremely ill. But one of the things I had to avoid, like the plague, when I was going through all of it, was social media, because of the fact that people only put the best parts of their lives on social media. So going back to life in likes and Instagram's been called out for the worst for a young person's mental health, because of the fact that this now constant comparison. And I'll give you an example. Some teenage girls just a few days ago said that when they go online, they obviously see their friends on Instagram, they see models on Instagram, or let's say celebrities on Instagram. And then they start to think that they wish, not necessarily they could look like that friend or look like that model or look like that celebrity. It's more of the fact that I wish I could wear that top, or I wish my body shape was, I could wear those clothes, but I can't because of my body shape. What they're actually subconsciously doing, it's not just young people, it's adults as well, we're subconsciously saying that we're not good enough. And that is a big concern now that I have in this world of social media. Social media is just one big social silo. It's very black and it's very white. There's no happy medium with it. You look at Brexit, when all that sort of kicked off and is still ongoing, a lot of people went onto social media and kind of said, yes, it's brilliant, it's the best news ever, or no, it's not, it's pretty awful, it's pretty grim, and it's not great. That's what social media is. It's a big social silo. You're either in or you're either out, like Brexit. But the real world is about debate, and it's about having an opinion, and social media won't provide that.
So this comes back to the critical thinking that we were talking about earlier. So it's about like looking at that image on Instagram and saying, does she actually look like that all the time?
Spot on.
And, you know, spot on. Is this Brexit debate really that black and white, and, you know, just
yes,
really
spot on.
That critical faculty?
Absolutely, and that's so important, and it really is making sure, and the premise of critical thinking is we want children to go to parents or a practitioner to basically say, I'm worried about this stranger perhaps is trying to contact me on the internet, Mom, what should I do? We want that. We don't want them contacting young people, of course, but we want them to have that dialogue with their parents. But the premise of critical thinking is just getting a young person just to take perhaps the iPad after they've Googled something to Mom or Dad and say, I found this online. Do you think it's true? Check the information with an adult, because how many of us now Google something and go past the ads on Google and think, you know, come up, check the first link and actually think, well, it's got to be correct because it's on Google. Google or search engines only find things on date and popularity. It won't be able to tell us whether that vlog or that blog is telling us the truth or not. It physically can't do that, but our mind, our brain absolutely can. And the critical thinking is such a crucial part of working out the difference essentially between fact and opinion. And on the internet, you'll see a heck of a lot of opinions, in particular that world of social media. And if young people are getting their advice now from vloggers, which they look up to online because they're essentially made millions off YouTube by being creative, which is brilliant, but they need to challenge it. It's not all real.
Yeah, no, well, the life that they're portraying isn't always real. And, you know, I've been building a business on the internet. And, you know, in the early days when I was following some of the big internet marketers and stuff, you'd look at their pictures and I remember one woman in particular, and she always had designer clothes on in all her social media pictures. Then she'd do a photo shoot on a bridge over the River Seine in Paris with the Eiffel Tower in the background, holding a glass of champagne. And then you'd see her getting into first class on an aeroplane to fly to Japan to go to another designer shop, and you were just like, you know, this is just, I just couldn't relate to her at all, and it made me feel small and little. And, you know, that's me learning to run a business. It's not a young impressionable teenager, you know, looking at celebrities and everything. So you really have to put it in perspective what you're actually looking at. And also, I've heard a lot of people say about doing a social media cleanse, and actually if you're following people on social media and they're not making you feel good about yourself, unfollow them. Don't follow them, because it's just not good for you and it's just not worth it in the long run, is it?
And it comes a very quick example that I'll give you, Lucy, and I use this in all of my sessions, and I didn't realise this. I always thought that the drummer in the Beatles was Ringo Starr. It wasn't. Before Ringo Starr, there was a drummer called Pete Best, and Pete Best was kicked out of the Beatles, and it all got a bit sour, and he eventually sued the Beatles for slander. And Pete Best really struggled, obviously being kicked out of the Beatles, because the Beatles went on to worldwide fame, huge, millions of followers all over the world, still massively popular now in the current era. And in the 1980s, Pete Best sort of struggled with mental health, and sadly tried to take his own life. His mom talked him out of it, and in a rare interview in 1994, he said to a journalist that being kicked out of the Beatles was the best thing ever, because by being kicked out of the Beatles, he fell in love, he had children, and he basically loved his life. But what he was doing, Lucy, he was spending most of his life comparing his life to the Beatles, and it's very unrealistic. And I use that example a lot, because if we're comparing our lives to what we see online, not just from celebrities, but because people only put the best parts of their lives online, they're telling everybody how wonderful their relationship is, how brilliant their new car is, how brilliant their holiday away is. It's very unrealistic, and it goes back to what I said earlier. All we're doing is subconsciously saying to ourselves that we're not good enough.
Definitely, and it's feeding that, isn't it?
Of course it is. But what's very interesting is when I work with 10, 11-year-olds, that is it's a huge worry that I have with them in terms of their self-esteem. But when I then work with teenagers, especially the 15, 16-year-olds, they're now telling me they'd be very happy if social media didn't exist. And it's almost like we've got young people using social media underage, because fueling the danger, or fueling the excitement more so of using it, is the fact that they're using it underage. By the time they get to their teenage years, it's almost like they're burnt out on it, they've had enough of it. And I'm hearing more and more teenagers say that they've either deleted it, come away from it, and it's actually been a really positive experience.
Yeah, definitely. I completely relate to that. I've actually started having a digital sabbatical, like on a Sunday.
Yeah, love it.
The Sabbath. And I find it's really weird, because I keep looking at the iPad and I'm like, no, don't touch the iPad. But, it's actually really good for me, and it gives me mental space and all that kind of thing. What I wanted to... I've got a couple of things I want to say, Simon, because you've got so much to say, but I just want to make sure we get these questions in. You were talking there about children using social media underage. So what age should children be allowed to start using social media?
Well, it's a really difficult one. In terms of sort of age limits, they're all around about 13. That's your rule of thumb. If it's an app or it's social media, some of these areas will say it's younger than that with appropriate adult's consent. I can't give a concrete answer, Lucy, but what I will just say very briefly is that when I got this job 3 years ago, I used to say things like to a group of young people, you're not old enough to be on Snapchat, so you shouldn't be on it. What I was finding, though, is A, that was very negative, and B, essentially what I'm doing is telling them off. Then what I was finding is that young people weren't reporting their problems to me or their teachers because of the fact that I've told them off of being on it underage. So I've steered away from that now, and in an ideal world, I don't want young people using it underage, but we do need to be positive around the use of it to an extent, because we want them to be able to tell us their problems. Yeah. For me, and this is what I will throw out there for parents, I'm working close to Northamptonshire Police. I would rather have a young person on social media, but parent having lots of dialogue and having some family rules and constant communication about it, because otherwise it goes back to what I said earlier. If we constant block, remove things, especially if parents often, Snapchat's on the phone and they delete it, young person then reloads it, all that's going to happen is they're just going to take it underground. And then when the police go in to deal with an online grooming case, it's not uncommon for a young person to have 10 different Instagram accounts the parent wasn't aware of.
So
it's a real difficult one.
I suppose as a parent, you need to be having that conversation with your children.
Of course.
About, are you ready for it? These are the benefits. These are the problems.
Exactly.
And what I've heard a lot from people in my village is that they're going on this kind of thing when they go to secondary school, so when they're 11. And to me, that seems very young, and it's such a sudden... the other day I was picking up my own children from school, and I was watching the year sixes playing in the playground. And I said to the person standing next to me, in September, in 6 months' time, they won't be playing in the playground when they go up to secondary school. They'll be cool teenagers, and they'll be on, you know, they'll be on WhatsApp and Snapchat and all that kind of thing. And I think it's such a sudden transition, and I suppose
it's
how you ease that transition for your child.
You're absolutely right. And that Life in Likes report said something very telling. It said that the transition now from year six to year seven, it is too much for year sixes. We have primary schools up and down this country that are too nurturing, and secondary schools up and down this country that aren't nurturing enough. And, you know, I'll give you the very similar to what you've just said. I had a year six girl sat on the front row when I was doing a session recently, sucking a thumb. And I thought to myself, how on earth are you going to cope with that transition to year seven? And in terms of online safety, the reason why the year six to year seven jump it is causing a bit of an issue is because you're absolutely right there. Them being exposed to more in year seven, they're desperate to make friends in year seven, so that's when they do more selfies online because they want the attention, they want the feedback. And from a parenting point of view, it's something just to be aware of, and you're absolutely right, it's being conscious of it but also managing that.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we talked a lot there about younger children, but a lot of the parents listening to this podcast are going to have kind of 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds. And so that, you know, they're approaching adult life, they're applying to university. Some of the children we're talking about are actually adults, being 18.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I do coaching calls with some of my students and parents, I see students sitting in their bedrooms with their laptops talking to me via the internet. You know, their parents know it's happening, it's all absolutely fine. But, you know, that's clearly happening in their bedroom. So at what stage and age can you start making that this transition into treating your child more like an adult and trusting them to have it in their bedrooms because that's their study space and all that kind of thing?
Again, it's a really good question. I think when I work with perhaps parents that have got teenagers, it's a bit like... It's the parents' almost judgment call, but I would say that with any age, yes, it's the earlier we have the conversation with them about internet safety, the better, because if you have it early and we get in there with the early intervention side of things, it's only going to help them as they get older. So if we teach young children in terms of, you know, bedroom should be digital free zones, all that sort of stuff, and we do that from as early as possible, then as they get older, the boundaries naturally are going to become a bit more fluid, because you're not going to give a 5-year-old the same boundaries as an 18-year-old. And the other thing is, you know, parents that have got teenagers, teenage behaviour hasn't changed from when I was growing up to teenagers now. Very briefly, example that I had where I live, a young lad was having a house party. I looked out my window, curtain twitching that evening to see what was going on, and I noticed that their behaviour of these teenagers hadn't changed when I was growing up in terms of lads desperately trying to get off with girls. they were drinking, sort of, you know, underage, all of that sort of stuff. It's about, you know, in terms of keeping children safe in their teenage years, and I know I said this at the start, but don't forget to challenge the behaviour, not the technology. The other thing, you know, I've talked that earlier about an experience when sort of drinking underage myself. I remember going clubbing for the first time in Stafford at the age of 17, and I know my mum was quite worried about that, but I don't think what mum did is jumped from bush to bush with a set of binoculars checking that I was okay. You can't snoop, because if we go down that snooping route, then it's only going to perhaps break that trust. So for me, I can't give an exact age. It is down to that parent's judgment call. But if we have the conversations with children early on about how wonderful the internet is, but how dangerous it is, then that's only going to help them in their adult life. And the other thing is that I mentioned is it's about this digital resilience. And a big part of digital resilience, Lucy, it is children knowing when they're in a risky, vulnerable situation. Because if they know that, they'll be able to problem solve for themselves.
Okay, so what are the telltale signs of a risky situation online?
It could be, again, young person on the internet, and you know, all of a sudden somebody pops up they don't know, is speaking to them and is asking for inappropriate pictures of a sexting nature. Now, you can look at keeping children safe and self-esteem in two ways. We've talked already about, you know, self-esteem and selfies and all of that sort of stuff, but a big part of having low self-esteem is also what makes a child vulnerable to online grooming. So if they're in a situation where a young person, a stranger's contacting them on the internet, or their friends are asking them to drink underage and they're not quite sure, if we have resilience, if we can build resilience within children, they can assess for themselves whether this is a risky situation or not. My own childhood, rural village of the West Midlands, I wasn't a resilient child. Parents made a lot of my decisions for me, and if parents are making all their decisions for their children, you're undermining their ability to actually problem solve. And a big part of that, a child being resilient, is then being able to recover when things go wrong.
Yeah, digital resilience.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about children making up their own minds and making their own choices.
Spot on.
And giving them a framework within to ask the, use that critical thinking to ask the right questions.
Yeah, and if I just very briefly, I'll give the example of my niece. My niece is two. I have a wonderful video of her jumping up and down a cardboard box. That cardboard box could fall through at any minute. If she bangs her head, it's obviously not going to be very nice, but if she does bump her head, she's going to learn not to do that again. Mm. And that children learn best by making mistakes. And, I understand that's very difficult from potential parents' point of view, because we don't want to see young people, upset, traumatised, all that sort of stuff. We want to keep children safe. And I don't want to contradict what I've already said, but it really does worry me now with young people that they're almost the resilience threshold is just so low, Again, I was going to primary school the other day, and a young lad started crying because it wasn't his turn to sit in the front seat of the car, and I really worry about that, because that's that ability to cope, with a setback. It's not my turn to sit in the front seat, so I'm going to start to cry and get a bit emotional and all that side of things, when actual fact it's about young people problem solving, and the fact that again, we can't, wrapping up a child up in cotton wool is just as dangerous as kind of saying, to a teenager there's free range on them, on a booze cabinet type thing,
Yeah.
it's the same sort of thing.
Yeah, so like I'm hearing you, and I completely take this approach and have done with my own children. Like if they're in the park and they're climbing, I don't stand too close to them, because I want them to understand that they're taking their own risks and all that kind of thing. But when they get to like the age of 15 and there's the possibility they'll be sending a picture of themselves naked to some lad who might be drinking and isn't very sensible, I don't want that to be a mistake that they make. That's not as acceptable to me as falling off a climbing frame. So how do you mitigate, allow them to make mistakes that they learn without actually putting themselves in long-term danger?
And I think that's the key thing, and just using that example that you've given me, and I often get asked that by parents or social workers, for example, and that example that you've just given me is in particular in their teenage years, where behavior does start to become more promiscuous, and it's the things of a sexting nature. It goes back, for example, that's behavior. So in order to, if that's been sent over Snapchat and it is of a sexting nature, we need to talk to young people about sex and healthy relationships. In actual fact, that somebody's persistently asking for messages, then that's not part of a healthy relationship. But in terms of the example that I will give you, again, a teenager that was caught up in a sexting incident, that mom went down the approach of rule setting, and we're going to talk this through, and she sent pictures to a lad that she liked, and the pictures then got passed around school, and it was obviously quite difficult for the young person to go through, but she realized she'd made that mistake, and in actual fact, by making that mistake, her behavior online vastly improved. But what I often say to parents, whether it's the real world or the online, on the online world, it goes back to a child understanding when they're actually at risk online. And if they're persistently being asked for messages of a sexting nature, if they understand that that's a risky situation, they will be able to work that out for themselves in terms of that problem solving. Earlier we do that, the better.
Well, so what I'm hearing from you is that we need to educate our children about the risks and the benefits of being online.
Absolutely.
But we also need to have very open communication with them, so that if they do run into a problem or they feel that something's not right, they can come to us. Is that right?
Yeah, that's essentially it. And the golden nugget, what I often say to parents, the golden nugget to keep children safe, and I'm so passionate about this because of my own upbringing, is that digital resilience. Throughout most of my 20s, when I moved away from home, I really struggled with that, because it was just that real lack resilience and not being able to sort of problem solve and work things out for myself. My parents, throughout most of my 20s, I was still ringing my parents a lot to sort out my problems, essentially.
Yeah, so it's all about teaching your children how to sort their problems out for themselves. So I just want to ask you one final thing. So if something does happen, like cyberbullying or kind of a sexting incident or something that's illegal, and it's something that the family can't work out on their own. So let's take the example of cyberbullying, because I was talking to another parent I know about this the other day. What should the parents then do, or what should they encourage their child to do if they're being bullied online?
So if it's cyberbullying, what I always say is screenshot things, get as much evidence as you can. Take it from a parent's point of view, the young person's point of view. If you can get a screen grab of the information, get as much evidence as you can. If it is sexting and almost online grooming can also merge in together, if that makes sense. So if there's a real concern there that parents have, never be afraid to contact North Hampshire Police. You have a fantastic PoLT team, the PFR line investigation team. They are fantastic and they will be able to support parents or teachers. Schools as well, I do a substantial amount of work in schools, so it's about parents as well keeping the dialogue open with the parents as well, and taking, you know, if they screen grab things, they can take that into the school as well. There's some fantastic resources out there. NetAware is an app by the NSPCC, which I recommend. The UK Safer Internet Centre is brilliant. Another very good website the parents can check out is ChildNet International. There are a wealth of resources in terms of if you have any concerns about sort of your children, but also don't be afraid to seek support by the school or the police.
Yeah, so to sum that up, collect evidence and seek help from a professional.
Absolutely, I think that's the best advice that I can give. And I've now mentioned this a few times, but again, if it's bullying, it's about behaviour and resilience.
Yeah, definitely.
So those two key areas.
Well, Simon, I think you and I could talk all day long, but we're going to give people a break now, and because what you've shared with us is so useful and so interesting and so helpful. If people want to come back to you about anything that you've said, how can they find you online, or ironically by social media, that kind of thing?
Yeah, no problem. So people can, I have a Twitter account, and the highlight of the job came 6 months in when a teacher asked to follow me on Twitter. It's not Twitter, it's Twitter. So my Twitter is NCC Cyber Safe. Okay. So they can always follow me on there. Or if they want any more information about me, the best thing to do is if you just Google online safety Northamptonshire, pop that into Google, you'll find our web pages very easily. So it's NCC Cyber Safe or Google online safety Northamptonshire. You'll find our web pages on the County Council's website and all of the information is on there.
Fantastic.
And we're just about to revamp those as well. So that'll be a much more, even better informative website aimed at parents and teachers and practitioners.
Fantastic, Simon. You have been brilliant today. Thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome.
A wealth of knowledge and your insights and your own critical thinking about this area, which I think is so important in helping everybody to move forwards. So thank you for being on the show today.
No problem at all.
Goodbye.
See you. Bye-bye.
Wasn't that a great interview with Simon today? I think he has so much wisdom and experience to share with us, and such a great progressive attitude towards bringing up our children in this digital and online world. And I really hope that's given you something to work with. So as Simon said, he'd be very happy for you to get in touch with him via Twitter, and you'll find his Twitter handle in today's show notes, which are at lifemoreextraordinary.com/44. And before you go today, I also wanted to let you know about three other related episodes that I have on the podcast. So there's episode number 4, right from back near the very beginning, and that was with Anne Goldsmith. And primarily Anne talked about behaviour, but there's a lot in that about boundaries. And so I think if you're struggling to set boundaries with your child, I think that's a really useful episode to go back to. She also talks a lot about communication, the importance of communication in getting the right behaviour and the right outcomes with your child. Then there's episode 7, which is with Frederica Roberts and Elizabeth Wright. And in that episode, we talk a bit about resilience. So that will link to the digital resilience that we talked about with Simon today. And finally, there's episode 31, which is with Daniel Licence. And in that, the whole episode is all about teen mental health. And Dan also shared with us some of his own struggles with mental health in the same way that Simon shared his own struggles with mental health today. So if you want to go a bit further and deeper with any of the issues you heard about in today's episode, then I strongly suggest that you go and find out about those particular episodes. Okay, I hope you've got a lot out of today's show. Yeah, I'd love to hear from you and take the discussion further in the Facebook group. So please come over and join that. Just search Supportive Parents Successful Students on Facebook. But thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day, and goodbye.